Scandal, a term common to both Bridgegate and the Philadelphia Parking Authority, both in the news this week. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Let's take them in turn. Joining me first to look at the ongoing Bridgegate trial is WHYY New Jersey correspondent Joe Hernandez. Joe, bring us up to speed.
So, Dave, the backstory of the Bridgegate scandal is that some high-level officials in the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey and in the governor's office of New Jersey closed lanes to the George Washington Bridge for political payback. So this week, the prosecution had its star witness on the stand. This is David Wildstein, who was a high-level Port Authority official. He's the self-avowed mastermind behind the plot. And he talked a lot about how this was retaliation, the run-up to the lane closures, and then afterward, the cover-up. The official story in public was that this was a traffic study. In reality, there was no study at all. This was just political payback against a mayor who wouldn't endorse Christie for re-election.
And as you said, Wildstein has been on the stand all week, and today was the opportunity for cross-exam.
Right, so he's actually been on the stand since last week. This has been a long testimony for David Wildstein. Throughout this week, he detailed on direct examination and on cross-examination how the Port Authority was kind of a haven for doling out political favors to people that high-level officials, including Governor Christie, wanted endorsements from. Wildstein said at one point the Port Authority gave money to a park system in Essex County to win the endorsement of the county executive, who they got to endorse Christie. The Port Authority also gave money to Fort Lee. They bought some shuttle buses, but the mayor there ended up not endorsing the governor. Wildstein also talked about telling Christie about the lane closures while they were happening. He says he, defendant Bill Baroni, who was Wildstein's boss, and Christie all had a conversation at Ground Zero on a 9/11 memorial ceremony, the Wednesday of the closures, in which they discussed this. And Wildstein says Christie laughed and joked about it. Christie denied that right away. Said he never heard about it, but that's what Wildstein testified. He also implicated the defendants, Bill Baroni, who was his boss, and Bridget Ann Kelly, who was a deputy chief of staff to Christie, in the scheme. But defense attorneys have tried to construe Wildstein as kind of a lifelong liar, a political hatchet man, as it were.
WHYY's Joe Hernandez. Staying on scandal, there were calls for investigating, even abolishing, the Philadelphia Parking Authority this week after the departure of its executive director, Vince Fenerty. That followed the revelation of two sexual harassment complaints. Now, this isn't the first scandal at the authority. WHYY senior reporter Dave Davies has been around City Hall a very long time and joins me now. Dave, what is it about the Parking Authority that seems to generate controversy?
Well, it's different, Dave. You know, there are 20,000-odd jobs in the city government, nearly all of them civil service, so that you don't get them through political connections. But the Parking Authority is different. It's one of the few remaining bastions of political patronage. There are no civil service tets there. So if you go back to the 80s and 90s, the board was controlled completely by the mayor. Contracts went to politically connected firms, and the jobs, 800 of them back then, went to ward leaders, committee people, the friends and relatives of politicians, mostly Democrats then.
Sounds like you have all the ingredients for mayhem and mischief.
Oh, yeah, there was plenty. I mean, in 1991, the authority's director had to quit after, you know, he had several relatives on the payroll, and it turned out his son was the authority's only part-time employee getting full medical benefits. When questions were asked about it, some documents were forged to cover it up. He had to quit. It was a mess. That's just one example.
Philly is a Democratic town, and you mentioned the patronage went mostly to Dems, though isn't the current leadership Republican?
It is, because there was a big change. In 2001, Republicans in the state legislature, voting literally in the dead of night, passed legislation that took control of the authority from the mayor, put it in the hands of Harrisburg Republicans. So the bulk of the patronage went over to the Republican Party, and it was their turn to get in trouble, and it didn't take them long. 2004, Daily News reports that the Parking Authority employees were being told that to keep their jobs, they had to buy tickets to three Republican Party fundraisers a year for a total of $275. This was a practice that was coordinated then by a deputy director named Vince Fenerty, a Republican ward leader. There was an investigation. The storm eventually blew over, and the following year, Fenerty was promoted to the top job as executive director, a post he held until he was suspended and resigned in disgrace this week.
Thanks, Dave.
Thank you.
WHYY senior reporter Dave Davies on NewsWorks Tonight. In New Jersey, Governor Chris Christie and legislative leaders agree on a plan to rescue the state's Transportation Trust Fund. It means repairs to roads and bridges and other transportation projects that stalled will now be able to get going again. Under terms of the deal, drivers will see a 23-cent hike in the gas tax. It also calls for an end to the estate tax and a slight reduction in the sales tax. The phone in your pocket has a chip more powerful than the computer that put man on the moon. Information can be moved and manipulated faster than ever before, and that's given rise to civic tech, a movement that makes data more accessible with applications such as real-time bus trackers or a website that can tell you if you're registered to vote just by entering your address. But as Keystone Crossroads' Margaret J. Krause reports, civic tech is experiencing some growing pains.
In the basement of a Pittsburgh public library, eight people sit around a long table. Split into pairs, they sit across from one another, waiting for Connor Seitz Bowen to start the speed dating clock.
So, go, talk. You guys ask questions, you guys answer questions.
If that seems gruff for a speed dating master of ceremonies, it's because this is no ordinary rapid-fire romantic quest. Instead of swapping ideal first dates, members of Code for Pittsburgh explain their ideas for making everyday city life better. One speed dater wants to know what's on the ballot before stepping into the voting booth. Another imagines annotated spaces. You could walk through a neighborhood and leave a digital note, asking a question about a zoning change, for instance. Seitz Bowen is Code for Pittsburgh's brigade captain. He says this eager reconsideration of the world's limitations is the hallmark of civic hacking.
There's a mentality among people who do a lot of computer programming that all problems are solvable. It's just that some are harder to do than other ones.
Civic tech is intellectual crowdfunding. If you give people access to the data generated by the government, they can build new and more effective ways to put it to use, says Seitz Bowen.
We have no idea what any given data set could unleash in terms of what people want to do.
The applications range from useful to fun. One group maps crime using the daily incident report issued by Pittsburgh police. Another created an application called Click That Hood that tests players' knowledge of city neighborhoods. Deborah Lamb is the Chief Innovation and Performance Officer for the City of Pittsburgh. She says these groups allow her office to do more.
There is just general resource constraints. We knew from local government we were unable to do everything ourselves.
Civic tech groups in Pennsylvania are largely volunteer and leverage what governments lack, free time. David Thornburg is president of Committee of 70, a Philadelphia government watchdog group. He says goodwill is the other currency at work.
One of the phenomenons that's become evident as the tech world has blossomed is how much people actually value contributing to something significant and sort of larger than themselves.
Those efforts have helped cities stretch their budgets, but greater demand for civic tech has stretched the capacity of these volunteers. To avoid burnout, Code for Philly is considering something that would have seemed radical a few years back, charging for their services. The group's executive director, Don McDougall, says there's risk there too.
We have this mentality of, oh, if we monetize civic tech, all of a sudden it feels like not quite the same spirit or philosophy. So trying to find that balance between it's okay for people to make some money on this, and if we want to grow it, that's a big part of it.
McDougall says despite how much momentum civic tech has gathered, it's still early days. She hopes groups like Code for Philly can become sustainable. Seitz Bowen's wish for Code for Pittsburgh is more expansive.
Pittsburgh should be a little bit better for every resident every day. The real heart of this is that, like, your life is better when your neighbors' lives are better. And the more we do this, the better things get. And we have no idea how better they're going to get.
Margaret J. Krause, Keystone Crossroads.
Keystone Crossroads is a statewide public media initiative reporting on challenges facing Pennsylvania cities. WHYY is the lead station. If timing is everything, the timing sure wasn't good for the Atlanta Falcons-New Orleans Saints game. The contest drew the lowest TV audience in the history of Monday Night Football. Joining me with more is football fan and professional pollster Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. Hi, Frank.
Hello, Dave.
Frank, a lot of those eyes and ears were otherwise trained on Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump.
That's absolutely right. As you said, record ratings for the debate. One way that we tracked it is we ask every night, did you read, see, or hear anything about Hillary Clinton? And then we asked the same question about Donald Trump in the last day or two. And on Tuesday night, those numbers rose to record highs. 91% of Americans said yes, they had read, seen, or heard something about Hillary Clinton. For Donald Trump, it was 90% who had read, seen, or heard something about him on Tuesday, which is a new high for him. Bottom line here is, yes, the debates caught Americans' attention.
And much like a football game, it's all about the winners and the losers. And by most accounts, Hillary Clinton was the winner.
Yes, our scientific poll, I say that very specifically, Dave, our poll where we use accepted scientific methodologies in the field Tuesday, Wednesday nights, a question that we've asked about a number of debates after they have been completed previously showed that 61% of debate watchers said that Hillary Clinton did the better job, 27% said Donald Trump did the better job.
Now, Trump in turn pointed to many online polls that disputed that claim.
Well, those polls are basically worthless, I can say, frankly, with you, Dave. I want to be frank about this. These are polls where various websites will say, or publications on their website, here's two buttons, you know, press if you think Trump won, press if you think Clinton won. And they get votes then from those people who happen to be on that website and who happen to want to vote. They're nice for the media organizations that run those polls, Dave, because they're sticky. You know, they keep people at the site and everybody wants clicks and all that in today's world. But they tell us nothing about how the overall general American population may think or feel.
Back to polling science. Among which demographics did Clinton prevail?
She did extremely well with her own party. Democrats, 92%, said she did the better job. And so then you look at Republicans thinking they would reciprocate for Trump, but it was just above 50% of Republicans who said that Trump did the better job. So the reason she had that big margin was that her people, so to speak, stuck with her. But Republicans clearly were much less likely to say that their man, their candidate, Donald Trump, did the better job.
They say there's nothing like a first impression. This was the first debate. Looking back over time, is there an opportunity for, in this case, Trump to recover?
Oh, absolutely. We've been asking this question after debates going all the way back. You remember it well to the 1960 debate day between John F. Kennedy and Richard Nixon. And one thing we have found is that the individual who wins the first debate does not necessarily win the second or third. Best example of that is Mitt Romney, who overwhelmingly was seen as the victor in 2012 in the first debate. But Obama was seen as the victor in the second and the third debate. And that leads me to my second point. The person who wins the first debate by no means goes on to win the election. Romney's a good example, as I just mentioned, in 2012. John Kerry was a better debater than George Bush, not only in the first debate, but in all three debates back in 2004. And yet, of course, George W. Bush was reelected. Michael Dukakis, Massachusetts governor, actually did better than George H.W. Bush in the first debate back in 1988. And George H.W. Bush won. So winning this debate does not predict a lot in terms of what's going to happen going forward.
We spoke earlier this year about the post-RNC and DNC bounce. Has Hillary gotten a bounce? And is it likely that it'll just return to the status quo ante?
I think it takes a while to see. The thing that we're looking at nightly, as we've talked about a number of times, is favorable impressions, images of the candidates. And when we look at Tuesday night, Wednesday night and Thursday night of this week, we see no change. We don't see that all of a sudden people are much more positive about Hillary Clinton and much more negative about Donald Trump. These images of the candidates are pretty fixed, and so far, at any rate, they have not changed.
Thanks, Frank.
You bet, Dave.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight. Next year would have been the 100th birthday of four giants of jazz, Dizzy Gillespie, Ella Fitzgerald, Thelonious Monk, and Mongo Santa Maria, all born in 1917. To mark the anniversary, a national touring concert called Jazz 100 will feature new arrangements of signature songs by all four. From WHYY's Arts and Culture Desk, Peter Crimmins reports the tour launched in Philadelphia today.
All of these musicians had a distinct style. That's what made Dizzy and Ella and Monk and Mongo Santa Maria so great. They commandeered jazz with their own unique sound. For Jazz 100, an all-star band will try to represent each of them in one concert. It's directed by Danilo Perez. He's a pianist and composer from Panama. He's now based in Boston. When he was just 21, Dizzy Gillespie himself asked him to join his band. That was 1989, when Gillespie was an international music star, touring dozens of countries a year. Perez says Gillespie taught him to use music as a form of global diplomacy.
He created this platform for cultural exchange, you know, through music. You know, many people were bringing a little samba, some merengue, some salsa, cubop. Dizzy understood the value of that, opening doors for everybody to come in and join.
Perez, like Gillespie, wants to use jazz to cross cultures, and he says the challenge is to bring together four singular approaches to music into one cohesive concert.
It's a very challenging, but they all come from the same spirit of creativity. So I brought a collective attitude. You know, I asked the players in the group to contribute with some arrangement and some ideas.
After launching this show in Philadelphia, Perez will take the band on a six-city national tour, and then they're off to Europe in the spring. I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
And for more on this and other arts and culture events in our region, visit newsworks.org/guide. Tomorrow, Animal Planet pulls back the curtain on the stresses and successes of students enrolled in veterinarian programs. Life at VetU focuses specifically on fourth-year students at the University of Pennsylvania's Vet School. One of the doctors in training in tomorrow's premiere episode joins me now. Dr. Rebecca Bernstein, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So how do you have time with the stresses and successes of school to even be here?
Well, if I plan far enough in advance, I can ask for a day off once in a while. So this is one of those days off.
Was it an additional hindrance to have cameras following you and your cohort?
You know, I actually really did not mind it. Once I forgot they were there, it was smooth sailing.
You know, there's this perception that it's more difficult to get into veterinary school than medical school. True?
You know, everybody always asks me that. And, you know,
In terms of the number of positions, more selective.
Correct. And there's not as many veterinary schools at all in the country versus medical. So in a way, yeah, it is a lot harder.
Penn is widely focused on both their Ryan Hospital and then a satellite campus out in Kennett Square.
Yeah, the Kennett Square campus is all the large animals, equine, bovine, zebras.
Though you were listed in the program as a small animal major.
Yeah, I try to stay as far away from Kennett Square as possible.
Much equine or bovine for you.
No.
In the program, we see several of the students. Is the program small enough that you know all of your fellow students enrolled?
Yes, the program, you know, by the fourth year, there were probably only 110 of us. So we spend the first 3 years in a lecture hall together every single day. So we know a lot about each other.
And then clinical rotations in the fourth year, all leading up to, and again, it's portrayed in the show, the anxiety, the anticipation of match day. What's that about?
Well, you have the choice as a veterinarian whether or not you'd like to do an additional year in a mentorship program, which is the match program, and you have to apply and rank where you'd like to go. And once you hit submit, it's set in stone. You can't change it. And once you find out where you've been matched, it's binding. You have to go.
Tell us about yours and then what you've learned as a typical, if there is such a thing, career path. You apparently knew as a little girl that the love of animals and then ultimately this avocation.
Yeah, I always had a love for animals, except I didn't decide to be a vet until, you know, 4 months before I graduated college. I don't think there's a typical path. I'm interested in emergency medicine. I know there are a few of my classmates and co-stars that are into the business side of veterinary medicine. I feel like there are just so many different places and things to try as a veterinarian. But, you know, we all have the common passion for animals.
There's an interesting scene in the program where a bunch of veterinarian students are having beers at a bar restaurant. What do vet students talk about when they're off the rigors of rotation?
God, it must be really, really boring when a bunch of vets go out with anybody not in the veterinary field, because we really do mostly talk about medical things or, you know, bad days we had or cool surgeries we saw. But, you know, at least when it's over a beer, it's like time to unwind and, you know, just hang out.
Thank you so much for joining us on Newsworks Tonight.
Thank you.
Dr. Rebecca Bernstein, and again, Animal Planet's Life at VetU premieres tomorrow night. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Our news director is Eugene Son. At the helm this week, Diana Martinez and Adam Staniszewski. Sandra Clark is Vice President of News and Civic Dialogue. Thanks for joining us, and have a great weekend. I'm Dave Heller, NewsWorks Tonight.